Welcome to An Honorable Profession, a podcast giving America hope since 2018. I'm Ryan Coonerty. Along with Debbie Cox Bolton of The New Deal, I'm lucky enough to be your co-host. An Honorable Profession is a New Deal Leaders podcast. The New Deal is an organization that supports the next generation of American leaders. From attorneys generals, to state senators, to mayors, to school board members, these are the people that are pushing policies and politics that will respond to climate change, rebuild our economy, address racial injustice, and restore our democracy. These are incredibly talented people who have dedicated themselves to public service when their country and their communities needed it the most. Check out newdealleaders.org to see what I'm talking about. You might recognize today's guest from her astute political commentary for CNN. Karen Finney lives and breathes political communications. She advises candidates and organizations on their branding, polling, and crisis communications. She was a senior advisor to Stacey Abrams and the Democratic National Committee. She also served as a senior spokesperson for Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. Today, she talks about the start of the presidential campaign, the fractured media landscape, and the role reproductive rights may play in key races around the country. At the end of the podcast, we talk about her family's complicated history in the Civil War and how it informs the debates of today. Enjoy.
Karen Finney, welcome to An Honorable Profession.
It's great to join you today.
We're so happy to have you as we're doing this special series as part of our podcast this year around A Road to November. And we're so grateful to you for your coming and talking to us about what's happening, what you're hearing and seeing around the, on the ground, and what Democrats are going to need to do to be successful. So Ryan and I are so happy to have you. I will kick it off with just a first question, pretty broad if I can, which is we are kind of transitioning from the primaries to the general election, of course. We know it's going to be a Trump Biden matchup. Just at the very kind of broadest level, what are you hoping or what are you expecting some of the messages that need to be put forth by Democrats, both at the presidential level, but maybe up and down the ballot to be successful come November?
Yeah, you know, I think the most important thing, and I think it's something we're going to hear for several months and will be most of this campaign, which is, what is the contrast? What is the contrast of the vision of America that President Biden, Kamala Harris, and Democrats have been fighting for over the last 3 years as we've come out of a pandemic? And I know at times we hear voters don't want to talk about, you know, we sort of want to be done with COVID and the pandemic. But at the same time, I think we have to acknowledge that there was real pain in our culture in so many ways. It changed so many things about our lives, and that we've actually come out of that and to a new reality, and that our economy is improving, that the president and the vice president and Democrats have tried to make progress on creating jobs and bringing back manufacturing and reproductive freedom, trying to, you know, protect basic freedoms, voting rights, also crime, and to talk about what does it mean, public safety and community safety. So there are a lot of issues, but I think understanding the contrast to where we're trying to go and what we have done. And what is the contrast with the other side? What is it that former President Trump says? And I think one of the most important things about that is in 2016, it was easy to dismiss a lot of what seemed like crazy talk when he would say, you know, Mexicans are rapists and murderers, for example, right? And we thought, no, he's not going to do a Muslim ban. He's not going to. Remember, we were waiting for the pivot, right? We're still waiting yes. for that potential pivot, right? And so but I think now we know that what he says is what he's going to do. And so continually making that contrast and reminding people also, and I think this election is going to be a lot about issues and the issues that we care about and the future that we want to see, particularly when we talk about climate, particularly when we talk about things like even access to affordable childcare, which to my mind is an economic issue, because we saw this with so many women during COVID. Like, if you can't have affordable childcare, then you can't work outside the home. And maybe you're not able to have that flexibility to work from home. And so thinking about, again, what is the future we want and how are we building it? And I would say the second big thing is we've got to meet voters where they are. There have been times where I think Democrats have done a really good job with that. And I think we need to really up our game there. And by that, I mean, we know that the way people get and consume information is very different, right? It's such a fractured media landscape. It's from YouTube, it's from TikTok, it's from podcasts, it's from cable television and newspapers. So we really got to be everywhere and think about how do we communicate our message in ways that suit those different platforms so that people are hearing us in the ways that they are wanting to receive information.
One of the issues that you brought up was this idea of choice, and you've written really thoughtfully about how the predicted red waves that we that have been talked about over the last several elections have been offset because women, rightfully so, are thinking about issues of choice. How do you see that playing out in 2024 and beyond?
You know, unfortunately, with the overturning of Dobbs, we've seen the what has come to fruition, sort of all of the things we were most concerned about in terms of, for example, the harm to women and women being criminalized and doctors being criminalized and lives being put on the line in some of these states where women are in an emergency state and doctors aren't quite sure what kind of care they can offer and what their options are. And that should never be part of a medical decision, right? It should always be, how do I save this person's life and make those best decisions? But now with what we've seen regarding IVF, and soon we are going to see at the federal level, a conversation about access to contraception. There are bills in states all across the country, again, trying to codify those rights because, again, as we know, when the Dobbs decision came, Clarence Thomas even said, hey, maybe there's some other privacy-based decisions we should be looking at. And we knew exactly what he meant. And so now we have to have what, you know, in the reproductive rights movement, we've been talking about is reproductive freedom. We've got to have that fulsome conversation that what we're talking about is everything from birth control or IVF to access to abortion. And I'll tell you some of the other issues we talk about is pregnancy discrimination and paid family leave. Because if you're going to say you're pro-family and you're trying to help people decide, you know, with those decisions of if, when, and how to start or grow a family, we've got to support all of it. So I think we're going to see a robust conversation about that. And I'll tell you, I think one of the most important things for people is get any candidate that asks for your vote, get them on record, ask them, where do they stand on this issue? Are they for, would they support a measure in Congress to, or in the legislature to provide access to contraception, to provide access to reproductive rights in terms of abortion? And where do they stand on IVF? I think it's important that we make people have to say where they are clearly, because we've seen memos from conservatives trying to help people figure out how to obfuscate on some of these tough questions. So I think we've got to really push the issue. And the last thing I'll say on it is we know that former President Trump is trying to run away from his record. But we also have seen reports that he's thinking about a 16-week abortion ban. And again, time and time again, when that has come up in state legislature or in states, people have voted against it because they understand that a ban is a ban. So again, I think we have to really make sure we're having these conversations out in the open in the bright lights.
Can I ask a follow-up question to that? I have two questions, but one is, I get frustrated, Karen, when I hear people talk about when they make it sound like it's a choice between talking about things like choice and things like kitchen table issues. Because to me, they're the same thing, right? And so it shouldn't have to be a choice in my mind. What are your thoughts on that piece?
Well, you know, we're still having to help our candidates and elected officials learn how to do that, right? And to learn how to, and to acknowledge that these are economic issues, actually. I mean, these are issues. I mean, you know, I remember years ago when we were trying to get contraception into the Affordable Care Act, trying to say, look, most women that I know, you know what you spend on contraception. You know if it's covered in your insurance or not, because that is money coming right out of your pocket. And so anything that is affecting the money in our pocketbooks, right, those are economic issues. But there are also issues that I think that there's two sides to this, because the other thing about these kitchen table issues that I think we have to acknowledge is those also go to just generally how we feel about our lives and our place in our lives in terms of, do I have breathing room when you are trying to decide between which bills to pay? Or, you know, I just opened a can of something the other day and it, you know, that and it was like half full, but the same price. And I thought, you know, it was annoyed about that. And so I think it's as much talking about the issues, but acknowledging the anxiety and the pain that people are feeling and how that makes them feel about their lives in a fulsome way. So a lot of it, I think, is just, again, having these conversations as clear a way as possible, but in just in the ways that we experience all of these issues in our day-to-day lives.
Yeah. You kind of were talking at the top, Karen, about how you, we have to both talk about what we have done as Democrats and what we stand for, but also then contrast that with former President Trump, of course. Like, how, as a strategist, do you advise people to kind of think about both being positive and negative? Like, what's the formula, or what, how do you feel about that?
Yeah, I think we have to be positive and negative and future, right? Because I think one of the big contrasts that we're going to see over the course of this year is we're going to hear a lot from Donald Trump that is going to be about the past, is going to be about readjudicating 2020, is going to be about readjudicating his record or trying to run away from his record. And we're, as we've seen so far, it's going to be a flurry of disinformation. So I think it's a task of both talking, you know, again, here are the things I remind people about, you know, what was in Build Back Better, what were some of those priorities and infrastructure, but sort of how that has been moving out across the country, and contrast that with, you know, the fact that under the Trump administration, it was the wealthiest Americans who got a tax cut. It wasn't the rest of us. Or he talked about, you know, part of the reason that immigration is in such a bad state as it is today. Number one, Donald Trump didn't deal with the problem. And number two, as we know, the system has been broken for so long and Congress has failed to act. And I think, and to that point, I think sometimes we have to acknowledge and recognize, you know, those of us who are policy nerds and we are in it every day, we follow it all a lot more closely. And so, and most people, they kind of have a vague sense of what's of the back and forth. So sometimes it is a matter of just being able to say, well, hey, did you know that, look, President Biden tried to do something at the border, and here's what was in that package. You know, he wanted to provide more resources for border security agents, make the asylum process go faster, provide resources for cities around the country that are dealing with the influx of migrants. And yet Donald Trump told the Republicans not to, you know, be on board with it because it was a great election issue. I mean, I think sometimes we have to kind of break it down for people because, again, people are consuming information in so many different ways. They're not always getting the whole story. And then, again, I could talk about what's the, you know, the future, because, again, I think that contrast where I think we're going to have this very, it's going to be all about Trump and all about his grievances, not to mention he'll be in and out of court over the next several months. So again, talking about the future, because really elections are supposed to be about the future. And, you know, the last thing I'll say too, I think for so many of our leaders and young leaders, you know, I think a lot about mayors and governors and state legislators and members of Congress. You know, when I work with people, I always say to them, talk to them, talk with people about what it is you are trying to do. It's okay if it didn't get accomplished, but it doesn't mean you're not still fighting for it. It doesn't mean that issue isn't still really important. And I think, because I think sometimes we think, well, that's a failure, I shouldn't talk about it. But it didn't mean you didn't try to fight. And I think half of the battle is, you know, I want people to understand. And I think as a strategist, I want us to be talking about the fact that we are in this to make people's lives better around a set of core values and ideas. And I'm a big believer of, you know, talking about our values and talking about, because I think that drives a lot of how we approach policy. And so I think that's important too.
I'm hearing a lot of frustration from elected officials and through the administration that there is a track record to run on. Wages have increased and there's been Build Back Better, as you mentioned, infrastructure investments, student loan forgiveness and beyond. But as you say, people seem not to be feeling it. And in a fractured landscape, they may or may not have even heard about it, even if they're benefiting from it. How do you see that communication happening? Or will it be Trump just sucking up so much oxygen that we won't have any substantive policy debates?
It's a great question, because I think it's going to be hard. I think there's going to be a real balance, and the media has a real challenge of figuring out, how do you cover Trump in such a way that you don't let them dominate the landscape and suck up all the oxygen, but that people are getting the full dose of this is who he really is and this is what he is really telling us he wants to do. Because to some degree, I think that's going to speak volumes better than any talking point most of us can come up with, right? And so again, I think it's part of why we have to be in some of these non-traditional and these, you know, new forms of communication. I was really pleased to see, for example, around the State of the Union, gearing up effort, a much more intense effort on the part of both the White House and the campaign to reach out to micro-influencers, to digital influencers, to really think about what's coming out of the speech in terms of content and how to repackage that for different platforms. I think that's a really important approach and things that we have to do, again, to understand how people are consuming information and are we providing it to them in the way that they want to consume it. I'm doing some work with Progress Now, which is one of the progressive groups on the outside, and they're doing a project of digital organizing. It's kind of an online model of how we organize when we do our grassroots organizing and we go knocking on doors. It's another effort to create content that helps communicate the message in ways that are more consumable, more accessible, but getting into people's social media feeds. So again, and also I will say, we have to recognize as well, there's a lot of disinformation and misinformation out there in AI. We don't yet know what role that's going to play. And so I think part of it too is, and this is something we talked about after 2016, we're all going to have to be really discerning consumers of information and ask ourselves, does that seem true before I retweet it or repost it or what have you? And keep an eye out for things that seem, you know, that seem false. I think that's kind of the other piece of that too. I don't know. What do you guys think?
I think that all sounds right to me. And I guess that, you know, and I wonder how much, like, you know, it's, you mentioned about those of us who follow this every day and all the time. And it's like, it's so easy to get like, you know, this poll or that poll. I have a question for you about like, what do you think about the polls? Like, how much should we pay attention to them? How much should we not, you know, are we worried about things like some of the uncommitted votes for Biden? Or is that really just an important message that people want to send, but at the end of the day, they'll come home. Like, where do you think we are? And what should we be paying attention to?
You know, I think it's a little bit like dating, and here's why, right? When you go out on dates with somebody, you're learning information about them. And sometimes it's just a snapshot of, hey, here's how they are when they're around their parents, or here's how they are when they're with their friends. It's information. It's not the whole picture. It doesn't tell us everything. It tells us, and I also think we always have to remember, it is a limited set of people who are asked a limited set of questions at a moment in time. And so, again, it gives us a snapshot. I think certainly if you see a trend over time, we should take that seriously. I'm not one who believes that when we have days of coverage about one poll, I think that's a real disservice to the American people. Also because, having done a lot of polling research myself, how you ask a question can really, you know, as you guys know, kind of shift the kind of answer. I mean, you can get pretty much any answer you want based on how you're asking the question. So I always think we should take it as a piece of information, just getting, you know, it's like we're dating, we're getting to know each other. But really, I tell you personally, I love focus groups more than polls because I like to hear people talk in their own words about how they feel about what's going on. And it also gives you an opportunity, because a lot of these public polls also, they don't do the informed vote. And so they're asking people sometimes questions where, if you were then to say, well, do you know what Joe Biden has done for small businesses? They might say no. And I'll just go back, you know, you mentioned 2022 and reproductive rights. I mean, remember that all of the national polls were talking about this red wave, and the rest, and many of us, particularly in the reproductive rights movement, we were just seeing very different data. And we were seeing that some of those polls weren't even asking the question, and they weren't asking it certainly in the way that we were hearing people talk about it. And then, not surprisingly, and I remember literally I was on CNN the weekend before. And so Kansas had already happened. There was actual data from voters voting, and people were still saying, no, no, it's in the polls. It's in the polls. So
Right.
Can I just mention one other thing on that? I think we need to look at how Democrats have been performing over the last several the special elections and the midterm elections, to tell us, okay, when voters actually go to the polls, what do they do? They've consistently been voting for reproductive freedom and an agenda that is basically the Biden and Democrats' agenda. So I think, to my mind, if when I'm looking at polls and I'm looking at actual voting, you know, I want to weight that appropriately.
Yeah, could not agree more.
Can I ask, you know, the New Deal is state and local leaders, and there are a lot of people in critical races and elections right now, or just doing really good work in their communities. What's your advice to them in terms of how to break through the noise, connect with voters, and get out of some of these national narratives and instead be able to talk about themselves and their work and the issues that are critical that they're on seeing on the ground?
Yeah, it's such a great question, because I feel like state and local leaders, it's so important, because they tend to be so much closer to people's day-to-day lives. I mean, you know, I worked with Tim Kaine, and he used to tell me when he was mayor and he was in the grocery store, people, you know, they want to come talk to you about what's going on. And that's so important. That conversation is so important, I think, for our elected officials, because it keeps them out of the bubble that leaders can get into and really in the mix of how people are really thinking and feeling. I would say, you know, I think New Deal leaders do a great job of this, but I think continuing to just talk about what they're doing and have the engage people in those conversations. And again, go on the, whether it's social media or radio or local television, you know, find those sources, those places where people are. Don't worry about, you know, sometimes when I work with local leaders, they want the big national story. And it's like, no, actually, it's more about if you do, you know, a great social media post or a video, or that actually can be more valuable, A, because more people might see it. And B, it, you know, so much of being an elected office, I'll just say it this way, it's about the connection you have to the people that you're serving. And people want to feel like you hear them and you see them. And so, you know, my biggest advice to any leader is to do everything you can to protect that connection, you know, build that connection and maintain that connection. And I know it's hard, not just because of the bubble, but also because there's disinformation. And, you know, I think our politics have really changed in terms of, you know, we're seeing more people show up and protest in ways that are really just unsavory, that I just think really disrupt democracy. And so I know it's made it a lot harder to do that. But I think finding more ways to, you know, whether it's, you know, going to the barbershop, going to the places where people are, where you can just have those conversations, it really matters. Because one of the things I've seen consistently in the data is when leaders have established themselves with their voters, their constituents, their communities, they are actually more able and better able to sustain disinformation attacks, because what people will say is, well, that's not the person I know. That doesn't seem right. And so I just can't stress enough how important that really is to, again, build that connection, build that trust, and maintain it.
We hear that from so many leaders, Karen, that what you just said about that inoculation people have because they know their neighbors, right? And they, like, you know, they're like, I hear this stuff about Democrats, but that's not what I think of Ryan or Chris or whoever it is. So I think that's a super important point. And, you know, you came and spoke to us at our conference in December. I just want to point out to people, and you did such a great job helping people think about how to communicate authentically, our leaders. And I think what you just said really reminded me of that conversation of just, you know, being yourself and maintaining those connections. But my question for you is, you know, we've talked a lot today already about kind of with your strategist hat on, your Democratic strategist hat on. We haven't talked a lot about your other hat, which is as a political commentator on CNN and other places. And, you know, I just am super curious, having, you know, you've done this for a long time now, how have you seen the media change in covering politics? And what's your thoughts on that? And how do you think we should think about that when we think about the media and elections, particularly heading into November?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think certainly for New Deal leaders, one of the biggest changes, as so many of you know, is the decrease in just local press, which means that, again, it doesn't necessarily mean that more people are getting their news from national press. It means, particularly in this fractured media environment, people are getting their news in different places. And it means that the mainstream news don't have the same hold and control, right? That people might say, well, I saw a video on TikTok. I, you know, what that person's saying on television, that's not what I saw on TikTok.
Right.
I was at a conference recently and this woman who was giving a talk about estate planning, and she just said, please don't listen to videos on TikTok because it's the worst advice ever. But no, and so I think that's part of the reality. I think media is also trying to accurately figure out how do you cover this political landscape, because you do have Trump, but then you have people who are conservatives who are not just maybe never Trumpers, but they still consider themselves conservatives, not Democrats. Then you have the independent voice, then you have the Democratic voice, and obviously within Democrats, there's a whole range. And so one of the things I see is different organizations trying to figure out, well, how do we give airtime to those different perspectives? And sometimes I think they are able to do it well, and sometimes I think they fall short. And the thing that I'm most concerned about in the media is this false equivalence. There's always this, well, they do it and you do it. And I think it's, as a commentator, I feel increasingly, you know, we have to have voices out there that say, no, it's actually not the same. It's 1,000% not the same thing. And to be able to really be clear with facts and information about why. You know, I see a lot of people coming on the airwaves and they're spouting, you know, talking points, and but they're not necessarily fact-based. So I always try to, I'm notorious for my notebooks because I have a little notebook with me all the time, and I have my notes and I'm, you know, my facts and figures, because I want them to know that what I've said is true. It's not just my opinion. My opinion is based on, you know, notable sources, reliable sources. So, you know, and I do think it means that, again, as I said, consumers have to be more discerning, because sometimes what you're hearing is opinion, not just, and understand what shades are opinions. And I do that when you listen to me. I mean, I'm a Democrat, unabashedly. So I'm always going to come at that perspective. I think media organizations are really struggling with the fact that they are competing with non-traditional sources. And so how, you know, if there's clickbait, then how do you get people to tune in? Or how do you get people to rewatch a clip after the fact? Or the headlines that are going to get people to read that story. I know they struggle with that too. And again, you know, sometimes you'll see with big news articles, like you got to get halfway in there until you're really getting the meat sometimes. And again, I think we just have to be aware of that. We're not in the, I'm going to date myself here, but the age where we had the three networks and once, but I do remember the time that once the evening news was done, that was it. There wasn't, you didn't go online. There wasn't going to be any more news until the next day. And we're just, you know, not in that environment anymore. The last thing I'll say too, is I think sometimes things are given equal, not just in the comparison, but they're given more weight than they should. Part of the reason we are talking so much, I think, about President Biden's age is, guess what? We've seen a multitude more stories about age. And I've had reporters say, well, how come Democrats aren't talking more about Trump's age? And I've said, well, is that your job? I mean, you're the reporter. So, you know, I think sometimes that's the other part of it, is that narratives take on a life of their own. And I think sometimes, you know, for viewers, they don't even realize that maybe part of why they find themselves repeating things is because, guess what? You've heard that now for months and months and months. And a newspaper on the television doesn't necessarily mean it's as big of a problem as the amount of coverage has gotten.
That's a really good point.
I completely agree. As we wrap up here, I want to ask you, you wrote a really interesting, thoughtful piece in January of this year about your own family's history, the Civil War, and how it's playing out in the current election season. Can you just talk our viewers through that? Because I think it's important.
Absolutely. And thank you for reading it. So what I wrote about, so I have a sort of unique family history in that on my father's side, we're a descendant of freed slaves from Southern Virginia. And on my mother's side, I am a direct descendant of Robert E. Lee. My mother's name is actually Mildred Lee, named after Robert E. Lee's niece. And my grandmother was Mildred Lee and her grandmother was Mildred Lee. And so what I talked about in the piece was having grown up with, on my grandmother's side, hearing some of the rhetoric around that the South perpetuated after the Civil War and during Reconstruction, when they literally were trying to rewrite history, and the ways in which they were trying to rewrite history about the Civil War, some of that rhetoric kind of coming back. And I started to think about it around the time that Nikki Haley was having so much trouble saying about talking about slavery and racism in this country. And part of her answer was very much in kind of talking about, well, she said it wasn't about slavery. She talked about it, you know, more as an economic issue and who was going to get to control what. And, you know, that was part of what was called lost cause mythology, right? That it wasn't about slavery, but that it was about, you know, it was on based on economic issues. And there were myths about Robert E. Lee that he didn't want to own slaves. And, you know, I remember my grandmother even saying he didn't really want to, but his wife had them. So and I was like, Grandma, he could have let them go. What I was feeling was some of those same stories I used to hear from her as she tried to justify who he was and this idea of him as noble instead of, to me, a traitor to this country, being repeated as particularly candidates were trying to sort of walk that line, understanding that parts of the core of the Republican Party may ascribe to some of those beliefs, but parts of the voters that they're trying to reach have different views. So how do you walk that line? And of course, the person who doesn't try to walk it at all is Donald Trump. And he had used certain types of rhetoric that were very direct. And also the way he has been trying to, this grievance politics, it was a lot of the dynamic after the Civil War, where the South was trying to, you know, speak to its grievances. And there you had this group called the Redeemers, who were trying to sort of, talk about this, you know, like Gone with the Wind, you know, romanticized Southern culture with slaves who are happy and, you know, these benevolent slave owners. And as we know, that's not true. But Trump trying to sort of cast himself as a redeemer as he is speaking to this grievance politics. And even, frankly, with Ron DeSantis, who in trying to control what is in textbooks in Florida and how we talk about slavery and how we talk about different issues. So I was trying to sort of make some comparison that as the country is in this moment that some call a third reconstruction, where, and I think in the aftermath of, you know, sort of the racial reckoning with George Floyd, and we've seen the growth in, you know, DEI, and I think everybody has tried to, well, not everybody, most of us have tried to really reckon with the progress that we have not made, and how do we have those conversations, and yet we're still hearing some of those same justifications and shadings on history, and we're still having to deal with that even in 2024.
Yeah, it feels to me like kind of goes back to the whole point about what truth is and what, you know, in this wild west of what truth is, it does feel very fragile, like our stories and our narratives, and like that this is a really important time to double down on truth and double down on and making sure people know history so that we're not just completely going a different way. So it was a really important piece. Thank you for writing it. And thanks for letting us talk about it a little bit. Yeah.
The other thing I sort of pointed out in the piece is that as a country, if we're going to move forward, we have to love all of it. And we need leaders who are going to be honest with us about that. And that was one of the points I was trying to make that I appreciated. Right around that time, Joe Biden had given a speech, and he talked about in South Carolina and talked about the fact that in Mother Emanuel Church, not that many years ago, we had a racially motivated murder of people who were at Bible study. And he was trying to say, you know, we have to confront these hard truths if we're going to learn from history and keep ourselves moving forward.
Right. Well, and it's so relevant because, you know, we're still hearing Trump talk about the fact that, you know, any kind of people who are talking about that we are still striving for perfect union somehow don't love America, right? It's to your point. Like we do love America, and we love America so much that we want it to be as perfect as it can be. And we have to acknowledge that there's still struggles and there's still progress to be made. And so that's, you know, I reject that premise, not surprisingly. Yes. Anyway, well, we have been so fortunate to have you on, Karen. It's been such a delight to talk to you, and I could go all day, but it's really, I think, going to be so important that we keep talking about all this stuff going into November with the stakes so high. So thanks for coming on and sharing your perspective with us.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having
me. Thank you.
I really appreciate it.
All right. Take care.
An Honorable Profession is a New Deal Leaders podcast. Thanks to the team at New Deal for producing this episode. We encourage you to bring honor to public service, and because we keep things honorable, no tax dollars are used in the making of this podcast.